And welcome back. It's very difficult to think of some modern-era war films without including the music. If you've seen Apocalypse Now or Saving Private Ryan, you probably remember the music. It was more than just background. It also played a starring role. Professor Todd Decker teaches musicology and chairs the music department at Washington University, and he is the author of Hymns for the Fallen, Combat Movie Music and Sound After Vietnam. I spoke with him earlier this week and asked why he chose this specific era for his work.
I think partly because these are the movies that I grew up seeing in the theater and experiencing as they came out. And a lot of the book is about how audiences have responded to and used these movies. So as ways to understand America's involvement overseas in war and ways to understand soldiers and veterans. And so I was much more interested in movies that were closer to the present. This was also my previous work was on the musical from the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and I wanted to get onto the other side of the 1960s and work on that culture.
It seems to me one of the challenges for movie makers and composers and anyone involved in these movies is you're dealing, starting with Vietnam, with a war that we lost.
Right. And that's the key musical change that I was after and that I started noticing in these films as I taught them was that a certain kind of music that was completely the sound of war movies before Vietnam had almost completely disappeared. And that after Vietnam, war movies started to sound, first of all, they put aside brass bands and you get, you know, rafts of violins. The march disappears and you get this very slow, sad music that would not be inappropriate at a funeral service or memorial service. And initially this music shows up, you know, in the 1980s films like Platoon that were specifically about Vietnam and dealing with the end of Vietnam, with the aftermath of Vietnam. But then if you watch, you know, Saving Private Ryan or The Thin Red Line, these movies about World War II from the 1990s, they use the same music. Mm-hmm. No marches, sad string music. And then the post 9/11 war films do the same thing. So I think the experience of losing the Vietnam War made Hollywood composers have to come up with a new kind of war movie music, and it happens very quickly, and it's still with us today.
How important is music to any film, but war films in particular?
Oh, I think it's tremendously important to war films. Pre-Vietnam War films, they had marches. Often these marches included soldiers whistling, like Bridge on the River Kwai,
right.
Or soldiers singing. They were meant to send the audience out of the theater marching along to victory. And after Vietnam, what music does in war movies is it opens up a space where Americans are invited to cry. I think, where they're invited to weep. And there's stories from Platoon and from Saving Private Ryan and things I've observed watching more recent war films where this music has incredible power. People cry. People stay in their seats. There's this great quote that I found about Saving Private Ryan where an audience member said, you know, when the film ended, everybody stayed in their seats and listened to John Williams, Hymn to the Fallen, except for those with no conscience who left early. As if, you know, getting up and leaving and not listening to this music was somehow not honoring the soldiers in the story. So it's extremely powerful.
Is much of the music, and I want to listen to some John Williams in just a moment, is much of the music original, or do we fall back on some of the great composers?
Right. So the seed for this new kind of music comes from Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings, which is used in Platoon. And this was a very famous piece of classical music from the 1930s. It was played on the radio at the when FDR died, when JFK died. It was played often on the radio and in concerts after 9/11. It's sort of a national piece of mourning music. And it's Stone used it in Platoon, and you can sort of trace the lineage of original movie music that comes after it for war movies that's like a dead ringer for Adagio for Strings that shows up again and again.
Well, Adagio for Strings. Let's, anything else you want to say about that, and then we'll listen to some of it.
I think what's striking about it is that it manages to sound like, and others have said this, that it's a contemporary piece. I mean, it's composed by an American composer in the 1930s, but it somehow sounds old or ancient or that it taps into some deep, older feeling. It's a new piece that sounds old, and it's extremely harmonious. It's a beautiful sort of music, but at the same time, it tends to trigger feelings of sadness.
Let's have a listen. Great sadness there in the midst of battle.
Right. And this recording is from the Platoon soundtrack, and it also includes sound effects from the soundtrack, so that in 1986, if you bought the album that had this on it, you not only took home the music from the film, but also the sound effects. So you could, if you wanted to, and it's a sort of a dark place to go, but you could sit at home and listen to this music, and the sound effects would direct you to connect this music to the Vietnam War. One of the things I was really interested in these films is how they mix music like this, sweet, harmonious, classical music in this case, and the sound of guns and explosions, which are everywhere in Hollywood films, right? Hollywood films are built on guns and explosions. But in these movies, those sounds of violence are meant to carry a real human meaning. And I think the music does a lot to help it, to help death mean something on screen again.
We are talking with Todd Decker, who is the author of Hymns for the Fallen, Combat Movie Music and Sound After Vietnam. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And we are back. We're talking with Todd Decker. He's the author of Hymns for the Fallen, Combat Movie Music and Sound After Vietnam. You deal in your book with more than music. You deal with dialogue, right, and you also deal with sounds. And one of those films that really struck me because of the sound was Saving Private Ryan, the first 20 minutes or so of that film, the landing on Omaha Beach, and the sound of the bullets. The zing, zing, zing. I mean, it really scared the viewer to watch that.
And there's a couple reasons why it was so powerful. Saving Private Ryan comes out in the late 90s, just after most American theaters have upgraded to digital surround sound. So the sound was louder and it was clearer. It was more directly placed in the theater. And that opening, I have a long stretch that analyzes that the D-Day landing in Saving Private Ryan from a sound perspective, and it's fascinating because a lot of folks reacted to it as a completely overwhelming experience. But if you analyze it and look at it really closely, Spielberg is constantly giving us moments to breathe. So there's sections where the camera and the viewer goes under the water, and it cuts out some of the violence. There's another section where Tom Hanks's character gets a kind of shell shock, and we go inside of his experience of the battle, and it mutes the sound a bit. So as overwhelming as that sequence was, I think it could have been a lot worse. Spielberg was trying to use those new resources as much as he could without completely overwhelming us.
Very, very thoughtful of mindful of the audience, needless to say.
Yeah.
But I've heard veterans who were there say that was just like being there.
Yeah. And that is another theme that runs across the 35 films that I talk about in the book, is that all these films make an effort to elicit that response from veterans, that it feels like you're there. Although a friend of mine who's an Army officer and often talks to young men who are going into the military, he always says the first thing he tells them is there's no background music. When you're in the battle, there's no violins or trumpets playing in the background. So kind of works both ways.
Well, beyond that, the opening scenes then of Saving Private Ryan, what about the music for that particular film?
The most interesting part of that score is the music for the end titles, a piece called Hymn to the Fallen, which is fascinating for a couple reasons. So John Williams' score for Saving Private Ryan has one set of musical melodies. The film ends, you go to black, and then this piece, Hymn to the Fallen, begins, and it's a completely different melody. It is a melody we haven't yet heard. It uses a wordless choir. We haven't heard that yet. So it's almost as if Williams uses the music at the end titles of that film to offer us this complete self-contained piece that comments on the film we just watched, but doesn't use any of the tunes we've already heard. And it's an extremely effective piece at that. I heard it, the St. Louis Symphony played it on a John Williams concert a couple years ago. And it was fascinating to feel the reaction of the audience who knew this piece was connected to a very moving and important war film. And you could tell that the room had changed, that we were no longer just at a St. Louis Symphony concert. Mm. Something about America was happening, something about how we think of ourselves as citizens, something about patriotism was happening without anybody saying we will now play a patriotic piece.
Hymn to the Fallen, but also an homage to those who fell during that particular battle.
Exactly.
Let's hear some of it. Once again, Todd, you mentioned earlier that movie makers, what they're trying to do is really stir an emotion in the veterans who participate.
Right.
I can see how this would be terrifically effective in doing that.
Right. Yeah. I think often one of the genius of this kind of movie music for these war movies is that it manages to do it in a way that doesn't presume to put a single interpretation on this war. You can look at, you can listen to this music and see it as a celebration of victory when it's applied to World War II. It works, similar music works as a mourning for loss with Vietnam. And then as it's used in post-9/11 films about the war on terror, in films about Iraq and Afghanistan, it obviously takes on an even more ambiguous relationship to a war that's still going on. So it's this incredibly flexible kind of instrumental war movie music. But the one thing it doesn't do is what old war movie music used to do, which is declare victory, that, you know, sort of unambiguous marching victory. That's one thing it doesn't do.
The music we're going to hear now is from The Longest Day, which is before the era that you're talking about. This, I think, is a counterpoint to help make your point about what it was as opposed to what it became, The Longest Day.
Many men came here as soldiers. Many men will pass this way. Many men will count the hours as they live the longest day. Many men are tired and weary. Many men are here to stay. Many men won't see the sunset when it ends.
match that against Saving Private Ryan. It's, you know, this music does not match the event at all.
But I think what's interesting is that in the 60s, when The Longest Day was made, 1962, it did, right? On some level, this was the music that the broad culture connected with the war, or that Hollywood felt would sell the war. And, you know, all these movies are commercial movies. They're meant to make money. Nobody, you know, you don't make a movie like a huge multi-million dollar movie like these war films, which are very effects heavy, without, you know, your eye on an audience and on making some money. And it's just interesting that after you know, before World War II, this was the sort of music that audiences wanted to leave. And Longest Day was a hugely successful film. It was a big hit. But after Vietnam, you can't, this music would sound ironic or over the top, or maybe a little jingoistic. You need something much more subtle. And I think it what excites me about these war movies, and one of the reasons that I'm even able to watch them, is that they take violence in the movies very seriously. They you are meant to be moved by death in these films, and that's not something most Hollywood films try to do. And so that's an exciting aspect of these films for me.
In The Longest Day, they had another technique for making money, and that was to put every known star in the universe into that film.
Right. Well, and they did that after Vietnam as well. The Thin Red Line has a similar sort of approach, but yeah.
You have 35 films that that you worked with in your book. Is there one that was your favorite out of all of those? I mean, there's quite a variety of films.
Oh, that's really tough. I think there's a film, Courage Under Fire, which is a 1996 film about the first Iraq War that happened to have. I did a lot of archival research behind these films, and that particular film had a very interesting relationship to all the war films that came before it, which were basically about Vietnam. And it's a film where I think it's one of those films where you watch it and you realize, oh, here's where a lot of these ideas for later war films were invented. So so that film, it also plays with time a bit in terms of the chronology. But it's hard to have a favorite. I do know that teaching these, I taught a class at Washington University on these films, and we watched, you know, in the course of the semester, we probably watched 25 movies. And there was a point about two-thirds of the way through one semester where a student said, you know, I'm just not moved by the death of an American soldier anymore. And I thought, wow, this, you know, if you watch these movies too closely or too analytically, you can lose the emotional impact that it's going for.
What was the music like from that film?
From?
The one you just mentioned from 96.
Oh, it actually is. It's the place where there are cues in that film that sound just like Hymn to the Fallen, just like Saving Private Ryan. It invents this sound that John Williams, I think, is borrowing from.
I think when many people think of music that really impresses and stirs the emotion, it would be Apocalypse Now, and that is not music original to this day.
No. Whenever I told people about this project, the first thing they asked was, well, are you writing about the helicopter attack to Wagner's Ride of the Valkyrie? And I have a section on that. I showed excerpts from it and talked about the way that scene is scored exactly to Wagner's music, so that you hear this, there are melodies and harmonies that lead towards sort of a big arrival and a climax. And on that arrival, somebody shoots an automatic weapon and you know, blows up this village. And one of my colleagues in the music department, who wasn't familiar with the film, but of course knew the Wagner, he said, I'll always remember this, he said, I think this is just terrible what they're doing to Wagner's music here. And it's a really disturbing sequence on a lot of levels. One, like I said, just for the way it takes these musical structures and makes the point of arrival and satisfaction the moment of the kill.
I think Wagner might have liked it, you know?
I don't know. I don't want to speculate about.
Well, let's
Wagner's
listen to
response.
Some of that. People will recognize this immediately. It is so well known.
Right.
That gets the job done, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, there's so much lore about this sequence, too. Coppola and Walter Murch, his editor, started putting the thing together, playing a particular recording, a George Schulte recording of conductor George Schulte recording of The Ride of the Valkyrie. And then they went to Decca Records to get permission, and Decca said, no, you can't use this recording. So they tried like 15 other recordings, and they determined that it wasn't just the music that they wanted, it was this very specific recording. So they went to George Schulte himself, the great conductor, and got him to sign off on their using it. There's also obviously this recording that we just heard has the sound effects mixed into it as well. And when they went to do the sound for this sequence, they found some actual helicopter pilots who had flown missions in Vietnam. And they brought them to the recording studios in San Francisco to add the sound in at the end. And they put them in this dark booth. They projected images of the film, put helicopter sounds in so that they really felt like they were in a helicopter, and just told these guys to start improvising. And they made them, and these guys got really excited and improvised lines with expletives and racial slurs that so some of the most famous lines of the film were improvised in that recording studio. One of the problems was that these pilots, because they were involved in a Hollywood movie, they brought their wives to the recording. So there was this, you know, bizarre situation of these pilots being put back into their helicopters, but their wives are with them. The sound in this sequence is really a there's a lot of interesting levels in terms of how they used it to put the whole thing together.
Why did Decca refuse? Was it because of the way it was going to be used in the film?
I'm not sure. I just know that I just found a letter from Decca that said you can't use this particular recording.
Another of the things that you focus on in the book is dialogue.
Right.
And I think back to the films of the 40s and the 50s, dialogue was always pretty weak.
Right.
But a lot more explicit, again, as you just suggested,
right.
Language.
Right. And, you know, there are famous films that I study, like Full Metal Jacket, that are just filled with profanity. And these films, I mean, the Hollywood movies only started using a lot of profanity about the time around 1978. So one of the first films I talk about, The Boys and Company C, was famous for sort of having this for being extremely profane. And that's the way we assume soldiers talk, right? But
no, I tell you, that is the way soldiers talk.
Yeah, that is the way soldiers talk. Okay. For all these films, I looked at extant draft scripts. And again, I found saltier language in the script than I did in the actual film itself. And even to the revising of famous marine sayings and poems and stuff that are used. And my understanding of that is that, you know, one of the interesting things about these war films is they're action movies, but they're supposed to be action movies that the whole family can go to, or that you can take your wife to. And I know going to see movies like Lone Survivor or American Sniper here in St. Louis, you know, whole families go, couples go. When you go see straight up action movies, it's a more male audience. So I think that they soften, soldiers in these movies talk a little less aggressively and use less profanity, in part to reach out to that larger audience.
So when an improvised explosive device goes off, the soldier will say, "Oh darn!"
Yes, exactly. That's right.
We all know. We all know.
We all know what they
would
really say. Yeah.
What do you want folks to take away from this book, Todd?
I think part of it is to understand, and I wrote it in part to understand my own relationship to war and soldiers. When I saw Platoon in 1986 in the theater, it was the same week that I filed my Selective Service card, knowing that I wasn't probably going to get drafted, but recognizing that being a man in America has entails some relationship to the military for the most, you know. And so a lot of us get it through these movies, and these movies specifically try to get us to have that experience. And I wanted to understand, as a musicologist who works on film music, I wanted to understand what the relationship between music and those feelings about being an American, about being a man, about being an American man, how those feelings were made at a time when the vast, vast majority of us have no connection to soldiers and the armed forces. And these are the movies that have done that. They do it for my students. They did it for me as I was growing up. So that's, I think, the overall goal of the book in a big way.
Todd Decker, professor of musicology at Washington University and author of Hymns for the Fallen, Combat Movie Music and Sound After Vietnam. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.